Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. I'm Jim Tedder. And it's time to go back into the classroom as we learn American English. First, Jill Robbins joins us. It's a great lesson. Then you can use what you have just learned as we tell you about new scientific research that may be of help to injured soldiers. So let's get started. Here's Jill.
For VOA Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. Today, we're going to talk about using the subjunctive. English speakers use the subjunctive to express a wide variety of unreal or possible situations. Today, we will only focus on how to use the subjunctive with a noun clause to express urgency or importance. For example, I suggest that you arrive early. The subjunctive offers speakers a polite and diplomatic way to tell someone to do something or stress that something is very important. It is a useful alternative to a direct command. A mother might tell a child, "Stop eating with your hands." How can we be polite and stress urgency at the same time? We suggest that you use the subjunctive. Instead of the direct command, "Stop eating with your hands," you could say, "It is important that you eat with a fork." Imagine you are a supervisor. You want your employee to stop being late for work. You could say, "Come to work on time." But a more polite way would be to use the subjunctive. "It is very important that you come to work on time." Or, "It is essential that you manage your time more efficiently." In most situations, the speaker using the subjunctive has power over the listener. In our examples, the mother has power over the child. The boss has power over the employee. There are two common structures for the subjunctive. The first one uses a verb followed by that, followed by the object, followed by the simple form of the verb. For example, his father demanded that he join the army. In this example, demanded is the verb. That marks the beginning of the noun clause. He is the object, and join is the subjunctive verb. That is optional. You could also say, "His father demanded he join the army." The most common verbs that are followed by the subjunctive are advise, ask, propose, suggest, request, and insist. Listen for the subjunctive in this conversation between cartoon characters Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck. In this scene, Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck come across Elmer Fudd, a hunter who is looking for rabbits.
"It's true, Doc. I'm a rabbit, all right. Would you like to shoot me now or wait till you get home?" "Shoot him now! Shoot him now!" "You keep out of this. He doesn't have to shoot you now." "He does so have to shoot me now. I demand that you shoot me now."
The subjunctive sentence in the dialogue is, I demand that you shoot me now. Daffy Duck meant to say, I demand that you shoot him now. Him referring to Bugs Bunny. Listen again.
It's true, Doc. I'm a rabbit, all right. Would you like to shoot me now or wait till you get home? Shoot him now! Shoot him now! You keep out of this. He doesn't have to shoot you now. He does so have to shoot me now. I demand that you shoot me now.
The second form of the subjunctive uses it is followed by an adjective, followed by that, followed by the simple form of the verb. For example, it is vital that he take his medicine. Remember, there is no third person S in the subjunctive. Don't say, it is vital that he takes his medicine. Fortunately, there are only a few adjectives that are used in this form of the subjunctive. Here are some examples. It is essential that you bring your wallet. It is imperative that you read the instructions. It is important that she arrive on time. It is necessary that she book the ticket in advance. Politicians love to use the subjunctive because it gives a serious and authoritative tone to what they are saying. Listen to presidential candidate Marco Rubio using the subjunctive in a recent speech.
And I just think it's critically important that the next president of the United States be someone that understands the 21st century and has ideas that will make America, allow America to fulfill its potential.
A good way to practice the subjunctive is to listen to political speeches in English. You are likely to hear both of the forms that we discussed today. There are many other ways that English speakers use the subjunctive. We covered some of them in our episodes on conditionals and advanced conditionals. Another common use is to express wishes, as we showed in our episode on modals of certainty and hope. Until next time, remember, it is important that you learn the subjunctive. For Everyday Grammar, I'm Jill Robbins.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Scientists have been studying the effect of explosions on soldiers' brains since World War I. Some military veterans who survived powerful explosions may become violent or experience depression. It may be difficult for the former soldiers to concentrate on what they are doing. Their feelings may change quickly, from happy to sad or even angry. Now, researchers have found that the soldiers' brains suffered physical damage, like people who die in transportation accidents or from a drug overdose. Bob Doty tells us more.
Researchers at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine examined the brains of former soldiers who had died. These veterans had been injured in a battlefield explosion, but it was not what caused their death. The researchers discovered evidence that nerve fibers in the front of the brain had been damaged. Professor Vasily Koliatsos led the study. He says the discovery explains why the veterans had a condition known as shell shock.
And that's very important because this is the site, this is the center of the executive functions of the brain, functions that allow you to put your life together, organize, plan ahead, understand, abstract. And you can imagine that this can make your life difficult.
Professor Coliazzo says the physical damage was often found near blood vessels inside the skull. He says this suggests that the force of the explosion pushed blood from the chest into the brain. This caused the brain to quickly swell or become enlarged. He says, when the brain swells, it pushes against the skull. The professor says that, as a result of the study's findings, doctors may decide to give different medicines to veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And he says the findings may cause military officials to find ways to better protect a soldier's chest. I'm Bob Doty.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization is urging farmers to be on guard against transboundary animal diseases. Officials warn that ticks, lice, and other pests can spread quickly from one country to the next. Experts from across Africa say transborder diseases kill between 10 and 20% of the continent's animals every year. The experts gathered in Cameroon last month to discuss the problem. They suggested large vaccination and pest eradication programs to stop the spread of the diseases. Dr. Taiga is Cameroon's livestock minister. He does not use a first name. He says pests like nosebot flies and wool maggots are harming animals in some communities in his country.
La peste des petits ruminants est une maladie qui décime près de 100%.
Dr. Taiga says all animals in an area must be killed if one animal is affected because the diseases are contagious. They spread quickly from animal to animal. He says that is why the Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Organization for Animal Health are working together to destroy the diseases. He says that when Central African countries succeed in killing the pests, their human populations will enjoy better quality protein. Sebastian Mongomo is an animal pest expert from Equatorial Guinea. He told the conference that diseases caused by pests have killed at least 10% of the sheep and goats in his country this year. Dr. Mongomo says the borders between Cameroon, Gabon, and Equatorial Guinea are largely unguarded. He notes it is difficult to control the movement of animals. Pests can spread diseases and also cause health problems known as secondary infections. Some infections cause the animals to become very tired. They may not eat. Then they die. Dr. Felix Njemi is an animal health officer at the FAO. He says the large number of animal deaths is worsening the food crisis in Africa, especially in countries south of the Sahara.
The strategy is the large mass vaccination at the country level. Undertake surveillance to detect any case of the disease and strengthening collaboration between member nations and even between international institutions. Imagine somebody who has 10 animals and lose 8. The disease can have impact in food security.
Many poor people in African countries depend on goats and sheep for their livelihoods. The FAO says people become vulnerable to famine when pests attack and kill their animals. And that's the Environment and Science Report. I'm Jonathan Evans.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In 1796, the new nation held its third presidential election. George Washington won the first two elections without opposition. But 1796 saw a change in American politics. That year, for the first time, there was more than one candidate for president. There was also more than one political party. The Federalists were led by former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, and the Republicans were led by former Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson. John Adams was a Federalist. Most people expected him to win. He was well known throughout the country. He had campaigned for American independence from Britain. He had served as a diplomat in Europe and as the first American minister to Britain. He was George Washington's choice for vice president and had served in that position for both of Washington's terms. But unlike other Federalists, Adams was not loyal to Alexander Hamilton. So Hamilton worked against Adams. Hamilton tried to win support for his own candidate for president. His choice was another Federalist named Thomas Pinckney from South Carolina. At last, the day arrived for counting the votes of the electors. The Federalists were shocked by the results. 71 electors voted for John Adams. 68 voted for Thomas Jefferson. Only 60 voted for Hamilton's choice, Thomas Pinckney. Under the electoral system used at that time, the candidate with the most electoral votes became president. The candidate with the next largest number of votes became vice president. So America's second president would be John Adams, a Federalist, and his vice president would be Thomas Jefferson, a Republican. Jefferson had resigned from public service a few years earlier, but he decided to accept his election as vice president. He wrote to his friend James Madison that he was willing to serve under Adams. Jefferson said he believed Adams was the only man who could stop Alexander Hamilton from becoming president in the next election in 1800. To Adams himself, Jefferson wrote that he valued their long friendship and hoped it would continue. Republican newspapers carried articles that were friendly to Federalist John Adams, the first time they had done so. Adams and Jefferson took office in March 1797. However, some Federalists believed their party's power had come to an end. Adams was a Federalist, but, as we said, he was not loyal to the party's leader, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton, sitting in his law office in New York City, did not lose hope. He knew he still controlled the top Federalist leaders in Congress. More than that, he believed he knew how to control John Adams. The new president made Hamilton's job easy. Adams kept George Washington's top advisors. The three men who had served in Washington's cabinet would now advise President Adams. Washington had appointed them at Hamilton's request, and they always did what Hamilton told them to do. Historians still cannot explain why John Adams, a man who did not like or trust Alexander Hamilton, kept the three cabinet secretaries. If the secretaries had been men of great ability, then that might be an explanation. But they were not. One was a Secretary of State who knew very little about foreign relations. The second was a Secretary of the Treasury who knew even less about finance. And the third was a Secretary of War who knew nothing about military matters and defense. Adams may have kept these men as an act of party unity, or he may have kept them because he could not get anyone else. Whatever his reason, the decision was politically costly for Adams. The three cabinet secretaries worked together against him. President Adams would tell his cabinet secretaries what he wanted. Then they would secretly go to Alexander Hamilton for their orders. In the end, these secret activities helped destroy the Federalist Party. They also made the administration of John Adams one of the most important periods in the political history of the United States. John Adams was born in the village of Braintree, Massachusetts, in 1735. He wanted to be a farmer, but he was sent to Harvard College to study to be a clergyman. He had no interest in that career and became a lawyer instead. In the years before the American Revolution, John Adams wrote articles about the injustice of British rule. He also became a delegate to the First Continental Congress. He urged the Congress to appoint George Washington as commander-in-chief of the colonial armies. He argued for the creation of a navy, and he helped develop the resolutions declaring America's independence.
We think of George Washington in his famous farewell address urging Americans to give their loyalty to the United States, to further its interest and not to be loyal to some foreign country. And that was what Adams believed as well.
John Furling is a professor emeritus of history at the University of West Georgia. He has written many books about America's founders, including John Adams. He says Adams wanted Americans to be able to govern themselves through their representatives.
Adams was opposed to monarchies, and he was opposed to rule by hereditary nobility.
Adams spent most of the Revolutionary War years in Europe. He helped win Dutch recognition of the new American nation. He also negotiated a loan from the Dutch government, as well as a treaty of friendship and commerce. After the Americans defeated British forces, he helped negotiate the peace treaty between the two countries. Then he served as the first American minister to Britain. Adams was extremely intelligent and was a thoughtful, lively writer. However, John Furling says, Adams often acted very coldly and said little, or he easily became angry.
If you thought of adjectives to describe Adams, certainly you would think of words like captious, contrary, gruff, egotistical, short-tempered, whatever.
But he says many people liked Adams after they got to know him.
He was certainly an excellent conversationalist, and he was filled with ideas, and he wasn't a vindictive person. He seemed to be a very honest person.
His best friend was probably his wife, Abigail. They were married for almost 60 years. Joseph Ellis, a history professor at Mount Holyoke College, wrote a book about their relationship.
They're the first power couple in American history. She has greater influence on policy than any first lady up until perhaps Eleanor Roosevelt.
Joseph Ellis says Abigail Adams did not see herself mainly as a hostess, even though she did lead social events. Instead, he says, the Adamses were a diplomatic team. Another of John Adams' supporters was Thomas Jefferson. This was strange. Jefferson's political philosophy was opposed to everything Adams represented. And the two men did argue, but they were also friends. For the last years of their lives, Adams and Jefferson wrote letters to each other about their memories and about the future of the country. Perhaps Jefferson liked Adams because he respected him for his intelligence. Perhaps he never forgot that Adams had fought hard for American independence. Adams had given many years of his life to the young nation. However, some people just did not like John Adams, but they knew they needed to work with him. Federalist leaders especially appealed to Adams' weaknesses when they wanted his support. For example, they knew Adams was jealous of George Washington. Sometimes, if Adams knew Washington's opinion on a subject, he would purposely offer a different opinion. Yet Washington, like Jefferson, respected Adams. He felt the new nation needed Adams' skills. And John Furling says Adams also respected George Washington, even though he thought Washington was not always fair to him. Adams' last public appearance was before cadets from the United States Military Academy at West Point. He was a very old man by then. Someone had to help him walk. And, says historian John Furling, Adams could not say more than a few sentences.
But what he did in that speech was he exhorted those would-be officers to model themselves on George Washington. And called Washington a great man.
Adams' personal weaknesses caused other troubles during his presidency. He belonged to the Federalist Party, but he did not want to become involved in party arguments. And he did not want to make all the compromises necessary in the world of politics. So other Federalists often worked against him. Adams won the presidency in 1796, but his term would be difficult. His own party, the Federalists, did not trust him, and he did not have the support of the general public. The people knew he believed that men of money and position should govern America. Even so, Adams did not expect the job of president to be easy. In politics, he said, a man must always walk on broken glass and red-hot iron. It is not easy to do this when you're not wearing shoes, but some men must do it. There are many dangerous things that have to be done for our country in these dangerous times. If nobody else will do them, he said, he will. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week here on VOA Learning English as we continue the story of John Adams on the making of a nation, American history in VOA Special English.